Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 278. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about deserts and mesas and pueblos as we go to the American Southwest and Four Corners. Got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have three news stories for you. In the first news story, you know how so many bags tend to look alike and you have to be careful you get your bag? Apparently, that also happens sometimes to caskets. A woman in Monterrey, Mexico had the body of her husband not show up because apparently it got picked up by someone else and delivered to the wrong funeral home. And then Bermuda has a new policy that may not exactly make cruise passengers feel welcome. They are having problems with locals who couldn't get on buses because they were filled with cruise passengers, so they're going to limit the number of cruise passengers who can go on the bus. And then speaking of feeling welcome, there are advantages to showing up to your flight on time or getting there early, as two passengers found who were escorted off a Virgin Blue jet in Melbourne, Australia, because weather conditions required that they load more fuel on the plane, and they couldn't take the weight of two additional passengers. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Eric Smith, who's come to talk to us about the Four Corners region of the American Southwest. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chris.
And I say welcome back to the show because Eric was just here a few days ago because we recorded this whole thing and I forgot to press the record button. So
let's
sorry.
Let's give it a second shot here and hope it was just as brilliant as the first one.
And then also Eric has been on the show three other times, if I have the correct count, talking about national parks, Michigan, and Yellowstone, not in that order.
That is correct.
So Four Corners. Why should someone go to Four Corners and what do we mean by that?
Well, what we mean by the Four Corners is it's the only place in the United States where four states have adjoining borders, and that would be southeastern Utah, southwestern Colorado, northwestern New Mexico, and northeastern Arizona. They all come together in a neat little Four Corners. Now, the Four Corners itself, there is actually a monument to the Four Corners. It's a Navajo Nation Park. And to spoil it a little bit, the actual monument isn't right on that exact geographic Four Corners, but it's close enough. And what they're trying to get across is clear when you go there and you see tourists laying out spread eagles so that they can have a little bit of themselves in four states at once. It's a cute, kitschy little monument. There's some souvenir stands around and everybody has a lot of fun with how they get themselves in four states at once.
And I'd like to try and act surprised, but of course we already gave it away that we've done this show twice. How far is the actual Four Corners from the monument? Do you know?
Well, that's something you read a bunch of different estimates on. I've read as little as 0.8 miles. I've read 1.8 miles. I think one source I said said 3.1 miles. It's all kind of in the middle of the desert. So I think it's kind of a subjective thing. I'm sure now with satellite technology, they could probably pinpoint it and move it. But it's already been there. And it's been there for many years. I remember visiting this place when I was a kid as well. So it's just it's more the experience. And again, it's a monument. So it's giving you a monument to the spot more than anything else.
Okay. So we don't really, when we're talking about the Four Corners, we don't really just mean that spot, but we mean that area. And what would you recommend that people see in that area?
the Four Corners area itself, if you were to go out and look for a map of the Four Corners and you were to get four or five different maps at a bookstore, it'd probably have four or five different ranges to what the Four Corners is. So I've generally drawn a boundary as to, I picked out a spot in each state that I think is a cool spot to visit, and I've made that my outer boundary of the Four Corners area. For example, I'm going to start in Utah, and I picked out Arches and Canyonlands National Park, which are quite a bit north of the actual Four Corners Monument. They're up by a town called Moab. And I picked out Arches and Canyonlands because as far as national parks go, they're both really spectacular. Arches is about 2,000 stone arches that have been formed by wind, erosion from wind over the years. And Canyonlands is this fantastic landscape of all of these canyons that have been carved by both the Colorado and the Green Rivers. And if you look out over, you know, Canyonlands can be done in a couple different ways. You can either get a good four-wheel drive vehicle or a high-clearance vehicle and drive, take the dirt roads down into the canyons and go exploring there. That's the long way of doing it. But I have a feeling of what most people do is they drive to the various viewpoints that they have. The Canyonlands has a few different units to it, as a lot of national parks do. There's one called Island in the Sky is right near Moab, and it's a very descriptive name, and it's for a reason. You drive out on this little teeny road, and when you get to the Island in the Sky Visitor Center, they've got a number of different viewpoints, and again, it's amazing to watch these canyons that have been carved. One of the other units is called the Needles, and that's, instead of large canyons, it's like it says, needles. There's more of the sandstone structures out there. And then the third unit is called the Maze. And with a name like that, I think you can probably figure out it's pretty remote. And to get there, you actually have to go down on the other side of the rivers and take four-wheel drive roads. And if you're going to visit the Maze, it's a 2 or 3 day experience to even bother going into there. Working our way south in Utah there, as you head down the road towards the Four Corners Monument, you come to the entrance to the Needles part of Canyonlands National Park, and there is Newspaper Rock, which is 2,000-year-old petroglyphs. And you can drive right up, and there's a chain link fence that separates you from the petroglyphs. But it's very interesting to see. There's wheels and birds and footprints that they've carved in there. And it's a state historic monument. And the canyons, I guess, I've only seen Newspaper Rock myself, but I guess the canyons are absolutely full of petroglyphs dating well over 2,000 years, which is fascinating to see. Some of the people who run the rivers there say that their guides can pull them off to remote canyons and caves and show them other petroglyphs as well. And I just got into it a little bit, but river running is a very popular activity. You can run one of three rivers, the Green River up by Arches and Canyonlands out of Moab, also the Colorado River, of course, which is the major river of the area, but down further south by two towns called Bluff and Mexican Hat, you can get with Outdoor Outfitters, and they can take you river running on the San Juan River, which is, of the three rivers, is the calmer and more easy, more family-related one. Also in southern Utah is Hofenweep National Monument. The Four Corners area is very rich in Native American ruins. When we get to Colorado, we're going to talk about Mesa Verde. And Mesa Verde is one of my favorite national parks. And it is a very dramatic setting for these ruins that are on a cliff face. And they're, like I say, very dramatic. At Hofenweep National Monument, the ruins are out on a plain. There are some very, very small canyons where these ruins have been built near, but it's a completely different lifestyle. And it's just as interesting to think, if you're seeing both sites, you'll look and say, well, it's obvious to me why the people would choose to live in a place like Mesa Verde, but it's not so obvious to just the common eye as to why they would build their homes out on this flat plain and this flat baking plain in basically the middle of the desert. It's hard to fathom why they would do that. And when you see those ruins were abandoned pretty quickly, then you can understand why. The final thing in Utah is Gooseneck State Park. There's a absolutely fantastic viewpoint there called Molly Point. Gooseneck State Park, it takes you down this very dirt and rocky road. And a lot of the roads in this area are meant for high clearance vehicles. In dry times, you can get by in a regular rental car or a regular, you know, any car that you take out there, you can get by in it. I was in a van, and still driving these roads, you hear the pinging underneath the van, and it's quite loud, and their roads are really rough. But the viewpoints you can get, especially Molly Point out in Gooseneck State Park, it's where the San Juan River changes its course back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And as you can tell by the name, you can see a 10-mile stretch of the river in just this small little viewpoint that you look at, because the river meanders so much that it's carved out these, the name Goosenecks gives it away. Also at Mully Point, you can look over the Arizona border and see Monument Valley, which we'll talk about when we get there, as a place that has all these fantastic rock formations.
Probably a good point to say that this is a place you're going to need a car.
Yeah.
If you're waiting for the trolley or the subway, you're going to wait a awfully long time.
Yeah, a car is really necessary here. Public transportation is just really non-existent in this area. Now, there aren't a lot of big towns in the area. We can talk about Moab, Utah, which I said is right on the borderline of being outside the Four Corners area. But there are commuter flights to Moab from both Denver and Salt Lake City. There's also commuter flights to the airport that is down by Durango, Colorado. And then the next closest place is probably Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is quite a ways away. So, you know, if you're coming from another part of the country, you're going to have to fly into a very small airport and rent a car. And again, if you're somebody who likes off-roading, then you probably have your own off-road vehicle, so that a lot of these areas, the people who are into off-roading are going to really find themselves in a paradise, but you're going to have to obviously bring your own vehicle designed for that out there.
But I would say from my trip down to Arizona, and I went to the other half of the state, the western half of the state, but you're still talking about a place that you want to make sure you've loaded up your tunes on your iPod, because you may not even get a radio station.
No, yeah, you're driving across vast areas. Of the four, I would say that Arizona is probably the most wide open, and the whole northeastern part of the state there, which butts up against the Four Corners Monument in southern Utah there, is land owned by the Navajo. It's the Navajo Nation Reservation. And it is, like you say, you can drive for hours and just see the flat, expansive plain ahead of you. And the sites in Arizona are much further drives. Now, from Moab to the Arizona border is also quite a drive as well. But I don't think in any of the states are the sites as spread out as they are in Arizona. That is a really good point. You have to really want to be able to do some driving. A lot of people, I think, include a lot of the sites from the Four Corners area, like the ones I'm going to mention here in a minute. They include these in a trip to the Grand Canyon. I didn't include the Grand Canyon in the Four Corners area, because if you're really going to try to get into this area that we're discussing today, the Grand Canyon is worthy of its own trip.
Sure.
So if you're at the Grand Canyon, to make a quick run out to the Four Corners area to see a couple of these things, you probably want to save that for a voyage another time.
And before we start talking about Arizona too, I think it'd probably be good to talk about Arizona. We mentioned that it's high, it's flat, it's dry. What time of year would you recommend people go?
Well, I was there in May. I've been there in May, and I've also been there in early June. And in May, it was really, really hot, especially the Arizona portion was still really, really hot. And also the Utah portion as well. Moab during the summer averages well into the 90s.
And we're talking Celsius. No, that's not true.
No, if you're talking Celsius, you'd be frying pretty good. But no, it's hot. And by the same token, though, when we visited in June, we drove through the Arizona part and were very warm. And then we drove into the mountains in Colorado and we had a freak snowstorm at 10,000 feet. I think wintertime would be better for Utah and Arizona, but the more mountainous parts are in Colorado and New Mexico. And those, you may have some roads completely closed by snow if you visit during the off time.
So shoulder season, May and September might be the best.
September would be great. Yep. My guess is, and I haven't been there in late September, early October, but my guess is the mountains in New Mexico and Colorado, especially in Colorado, the fall colors are probably pretty spectacular in Colorado during the fall season as well.
Okay. And then you started to go into Arizona.
Yeah, Arizona's tough because there are sites right near the Four Corners Monument that are great. You don't have to drive a long way for them. A couple that are just a little further out, the Petrified Forest National Park, which includes the Painted Desert area, which the Petrified Forest is really fascinating in its own right. But the colors of the Painted Desert are just outstanding and well worth a trip. That's quite a ways away from the monument again, a couple, 2-3 hours drive at least down heading towards Phoenix. It's quite a ways away, but I've taken that as kind of my outer part of the Four Corners area in Arizona. As you get closer to the monument itself, there is Canyon de Chelly National Monument. And Canyon de Chelly is a unique national park because it's owned both by the National Park Service, the American people, but also it's actually technically owned by the Navajo Trust. There's sort of a joint ownership issue, but this is one of the unique national parks where the land has actually been given back to the Native American people of the area, the Navajo, and they really do manage it. Canyon de Chelly is not the Grand Canyon, but it is a spectacular canyon in its own right. It is not as deep as the Grand Canyon, but it is more used than the Grand Canyon. For example, there are also some Indian ruins down in the canyon itself, but there are still cultivated fields in the canyon. And Canyon de Chelly can be done in two ways. You can drive around the rim drives. There's a canyon to the north and a canyon to the south. And as the National Park Service always does, they both have great scenic drives. So you can drive the scenic drives, pull up at viewpoints, look out over what's below you, and take really great pictures of the canyon. But also available at Canyon de Chelly is there are Navajo tour companies that will hire you a guide and take you right down into the canyon themselves. And the day I was there, I was unable to actually book one. I should have booked it in advance, and I did not do it in advance, so I was not able to go. But the people who have been there that I've talked to, who have taken the guides down into the canyon, say that that was very clearly a highlight of their trip, was going down in the canyon, not only to see the ruins up close, but to see how the canyon is still used today. And Canyon de Chelly is a sacred place to the Navajo, so you get to find out a little more about how the people feel about this really beautiful, beautiful canyon. Moving north from Canyon de Chelly towards the monument itself, right on the border with southern Utah is two very, very scenic drives. It's Monument Valley Tribal Park and also the Valley of the Gods. Monument Valley Tribal Park is, again, another Navajo Nation park, and you pay, I think it's $5, and you're able to drive another one of these really rocky dirt roads. But you drive around and you see these fantastic formations in the areas. There's one called the Three Sisters, which is three sandstone pillars, and it's so unnatural. It looks like they've almost been carved. At another point on the drive, there's something called the Mittens, which look like two stone hands sticking up out of the earth, complete with thumbs. Now, they're not obviously to the detail of hands, but they do look like somebody below the earth's surface has pushed their hands through the earth's surface in a pair of mittens. And there's a lot of formations like that. There's Elephant Butte, but it's a great drive around in a very, very scenic place. I know one photographer who I talked to said that it was his favorite place to do photography at sunset, because some of the sunsets would color the rocks differently and the shadows would always work really well there. So it's a very popular place at sunset.
Well, and we didn't talk about this last time, but just outside the region that we're talking about, in about the middle of Arizona, at the top near Page, Arizona, is my favorite place as a photographer, which is Antelope Canyon. And we've done another show on that a long, long time ago in the archives. You can find that. Again, we're half a state away from Four Corners by that point, though.
Yeah, and you get over to Page, and you've got the boat trips out to Rainbow Bridge National Monument, which I've been to a lot of national parks, and it's one of those ones where time commitment-wise, the three times I've been down there, it's been hard for me to devote a whole day to taking the boat tour out. So that's what I'm saying. You could – the Four Corners is so diverse, you could spend 2 weeks in each of these states in consecutive years and still probably not exhaust at all. So yeah, it's very amazing.
Well, and it seems like in terms of what we're talking about here too, in terms of scale, you could probably do a lot of this in a week if you just wanted to drive, stay in the car the whole time. And probably what we're talking about is at least 2 weeks at a more reasonable pace, and you're probably going to have to pick and choose.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll have to decide what appeals to you. A lot of people can do that different ways. You read what you find fascinating, or what you read on the internet. You listen to an amazing podcast about the area and choose what things appeal to your interest. And then also what I always find, and I found this when I went to Israel last year on a trip that was inspired by the Amateur Travel. I took a lot of what the guests there said and incorporated that into my own trip. But as I got further trip planning, I would look through books and I thought, boy, this looks really neat. And he didn't talk about this, but this is something I've got to see. So that's with the availability of the internet now, you can look online and say, boy, that is just something I absolutely have to see. And one thing we have briefly touched on is the fact that this area is really, really rich in unique outdoor opportunities. We mentioned the river running in the Utah section and the Navajo tribal guides in the Arizona section. But there's also a company out of Moab that does hot air balloon rides. Moab, it has one of America's finest mountain biking cultures.
Absolutely.
So you can go there, and there's a famous trail called the Slick Rock Trail, which a lot of people go and do. And there's climbing. There's just so much that you can choose from here that, again, there are tough choices to make and you have to decide. That's why I've had to make two trips into this area. I just did not have enough time the first time around to hit it all. And I figured, well, let's pick and choose what I want to see this first time and kind of keep it sectioned off geographically and then have to go back for some of the stuff later.
Okay. Now, do we want to go up to Colorado next?
Sure. Colorado is gorgeous. The section is really amazing. The mountains here. Colorado is one of my favorite states. If I could extend it beyond, you know, I could push the Four Corners region all the way up to Denver, but I'm not going to do that. I am going to extend it a little further, though, about even with where Moab is in Utah, to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park, which is one of these national parks that a lot of people have heard of. And it is, you hear the word canyons, and I'm going to use it a lot because this area is real big in canyons, but they're all different. Black Canyon is so much different than Canyon de Chelly or the Grand Canyon or Antelope Canyon, like you mentioned. The Black Canyon of the Gunnison, it's a much darker colored rock. It's also a very steep canyon, and it has the little ribbon of the Gunnison River running through the bottom of it. Now, the thing I loved most about Black Canyon of the Gunnison was stopping at the National Parks Visitor Center and watching the film on the earliest explorers who ran the river through the canyon. These are truly crazy people. Because the river is moving really fast. You look at how this canyon was formed by this, what looks like a little river. It just gives you an idea of how fast this river is really moving. And they were going through, I mean, today the river is mostly not run because of how fierce it is. So for these people to be going through on wooden rafts in makeshift canoes, it's just absolutely crazy to even imagine. But Black Canyon of the Gunnison has just amazing viewpoints everywhere as well. It's got a 6 or 7 mile rim drive that you can take out to the edge of the canyon. And then, you stop every once in a while and get out and overlook the canyon and take some pictures. It's one of those places where you walk up to it and you look at it and it gives you an instant sense of vertigo. The walls are so sheer. And it's mm-hmm. unique because you can see the way the rocks have been carved over the years. There's actual patterns in both sides of the rock walls. It's really amazing. From Black Canyon of the Gunnison, if you head south towards the actual Four Corners Monument, you're going to go down US 550, which for a stretch is called the Million Dollar Highway. Now, we talked when we recorded this the last time about how I looked even in between recordings on why it's been called the Million Dollar Highway, and there are at least 5 different reasons that people have given it that name. Some people say it's because it cost $1 million per square mile to build, and from looking at the way this road has been engineered, you could tell that that might be true. But I'd say I like the Million Dollar name because the views on it are Million Dollar views. Everywhere you go, every corner you turn, you have these amazing snow-capped mountains and then the small mountain streams and the small mountain lakes. And it's just a really unique area. And along the Million Dollar Highway are some old silver mining towns, one called Silverton. And Silverton's a National Historic District now. And it's very touristy, of course, as you would figure from a place like this. But it's all these buildings that have been kept over the years from the silver mining rush in that area. They're all very unique. The town hall in Silverton is a big stone building that you can tell is obviously very old, but has been very well maintained. And Silverton's a great place for kids because it's in the mountains, so it's not the OK Corral type Wild West, but there's still a very Old West feeling to Silverton. And Silverton, between Durango, which is the biggest city in the area, and Silverton, there is the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railway, which is a great excursion to do it. We talked about looking for feelings of the Old West. Well, what's more Old West than taking a train through the mountains between two former mining towns? Now, this is something that I know a lot of families enjoy a lot, but it also can be a very expensive excursion as well. I think the price I quoted last time was it can be almost $200 a person, depending on the excursion that you take. But
and that really surprised me when you quoted that price, too. I mean, yeah. More expensive than usually those are.
Yeah, I believe that's the higher end package, but there are cheaper ones as well. But this still is going to be an expensive excursion either way. But I have a feeling, and I have not done it since I was, I think we did this trip when I was 12, when I was younger. So I remember it being very cool. Obviously, I don't remember my parents wincing as they walked up to pay the ticket price. But it's one of those things where I would imagine the experience, if it wasn't worth it, they wouldn't be able to charge that much and it wouldn't be nearly as popular. Almost every guidebook, almost every internet resource about the area talks first about the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railway. So I think that that's one of those things that people find really well worth it. And then heading towards the monument from there, you get to Durango and you have a choice. You can go south into New Mexico, or you can head west towards Cortez, Colorado, which takes you towards Mesa Verde National Park. Now, Mesa Verde National Park is, as I've mentioned, one of my favorite parks. The setting is amazing because you get to Mesa Verde and you drive up this little windy road. Mesa Verde, obviously, this is my very limited Spanish, is Spanish for green table. So you drive from the base of these mountains. You can see the mountains, and it says Mesa Verde National Park here, and you can't see any Indian ruins when you look up at the elevated part of the mountains there. But you take this little winding road up into the mountains, and it's quite a drive. It's 15 or 16 miles up into these mountains. And you get up into the mountains, and you pull over at the Farview Visitor Center, and you book your tours to this, to one of the ruins. You don't have to book a tour, but I would highly recommend it. And then you drive further down the road, and you get out of the car, and you're still thinking, well, it's a very pretty area, but I haven't seen anything. And then you come to this overlook, and you look down into these smaller canyons, and right on the cliff wall there, in an indentation in the cliff wall, is what looks like a mini city or a mini apartment complex built with all these different buildings of different sizes. And again, it's like a little mini teeny city built into the side of the cliff itself. And some of the tours do some really neat things, like taking ladders to get there. The one that I specifically think about is the Spruce Tree House, which is available on a self-guided tour. It's the one I did last time I was there in 2009, where my father and I were able to walk down the one side of the canyon with glimpses here and there of the ruins themselves, and then through the base of the canyon in this very lush green area, and then up the other side a little ways, and then onto the platform where the ruins are themselves. And you can't climb around in the ruins, but you can walk around in front of them. And it's just an amazing experience. I'm sure the question that they get most is, how could these have been abandoned? And the simple reason for it is, well, we don't know. The most likely reason is because the area did experience a drought. And you can see when you're in these ruins at Mesa Verde how the water was able to run through the stone that these cliffs are made of. Mm-hmm. And the people were able to collect the water in there because defensive-wise, these would be great places to live, but they are not close to a water source in a lot of cases. But having lived in the area for a while, I'm sure they figured out that the water ran through the rock and they were able to make themselves some really good places to collect water. And like I say, Mesa Verde, if you want to go on a tour there, you're best to get to the visitor center early in the morning and book one of those, especially during peak season, during the summer. It's not the most visited national park, but the tours do fill up pretty fast. And it's one of those places where if you read the website, they do advise you get there early to try to book a tour if that's what you're interested in doing.
Excellent. I think that just leaves one state left.
It does. It leaves New Mexico. And New Mexico, again, you can go further away from the Four Corners area. And as I've been starting with all the other states, the furthest area away in New Mexico, you can go visit some pueblos. Now, there's Taos Pueblo, which is a long ways away. That's over towards the middle of the state. If you head south, there's both Acoma and Zuni Pueblos. Zuni Pueblo is an artistic community, and it's also been lived in for a very long time. The one that I found most fascinating was Acoma Pueblo, which is, they call it Sky City. It's built on top of a butte in the middle of this desert. And you go to the visitor center and you can't visit the Pueblo without a guide. So you book a tour and they take you up in a little van and you walk around this city that is the longest inhabited city in the American Southwest. And it's unique. Now, the buildings have all been modernized a lot, but it's a very dramatic setting for a city to be built on top of a butte. Cliffs all around. Obviously a great defensive place. And that was one of the tours that I found just was really enjoyable. And you can't see it without a tour, but I wouldn't have wanted to be there without a tour. Heading north in New Mexico towards the Four Corners Monument, as we've done with the other states, is Chaco Culture National Historic Park. Now, this is another, like Mesa Verde, it's a UNESCO heritage site. And Chaco Culture is kind of unique because you read the website and it talks about how we talked about the rough roads. And this is another one where you have to take a rough, unpaved road for a long time out. And there's many warnings, not only on the website, but on the road as you're heading out towards the canyon itself, saying in wet weather, don't try to take this road because as a lot of desert regions, a lot of part of the road will flood. There will be these flash floods in the area. So you get on this road. My father and I, when we visited in 2009, we drove out to the road and we saw all these warnings. And it was an overcast day. There was no rain in the forecast, but it was overcast. Yet still, we looked up at the sky and thought, let's just get to the canyon. Well, when you get out to the canyon itself, and it's a pretty fair drive of 20 or 30 miles out to the canyon itself. When you get to the national park boundaries, it's a paved road. And Chaco culture is different from Mesa Verde in that it's not dramatic like the canyons are at Mesa Verde or at Canyon de Chelly. It's a more wide open canyon, and it's a nice cross between Mesa Verde and what we mentioned in Hovenweep, whereas the ruins there are built out more in a flat area, including one of the largest I have ever seen, which is called Pueblo Benito, which covers over 2 acres. And Chaco culture is another one of those places that was very sacred to the people who said it, and it was one of the ones that was inhabited the longest. It was inhabited between 900 and 1150 AD. So you look at Hovenweep, which was inhabited for not even 100 years, and Mesa Verde, same thing, in the 100-year range. Yeah, but you look at Chaco Canyon, there was well over 250 years from the best that they can determine. And it's still very sacred to the Hopi and the relatives of the Pueblo people. But Chaco is a very nice place because you have these ruins, but you can also take trails in between the ruins and see petroglyphs. And the time we were out there in early June, we had almost the whole canyon to ourselves. We got there very early in the morning, as I usually do. It was on 7 a.m. when we first pulled up and saw some ruins even before we visited the visitor center. And we had the place to ourselves for a good 2 hours, and we saw an abundance of desert wildlife. There were lots of lizards. There were these small little rabbits, which I never did find the name out. And it was a really peaceful setting. And you, at that time, you could look at it and say, I can understand why people would choose to live in this particular canyon. And it's one of those sites where you have to put a little work in to go see it. But when you get out there, I think you can instantly understand why it is got the reputation it does. The last thing I guess I would mention about New Mexico is there's another small national park site up near a town called Aztec, up near Farmington, New Mexico, which is one of the bigger cities in the area that has – it's where you'll have to go for your food and for your lodging and for your modern amenities. It's called Aztec Ruins National Monument. And the highlight of Aztec Ruins – now, obviously, the Aztecs never lived in New Mexico. So the name, it kind of honors the first discoverers of it, showing you how little they actually knew about what it is they'd stumbled upon. They'd assumed somehow or another the Aztecs made it all the way up from Central and South America to settle in New Mexico there when it wasn't that at all. It's an ancient Hopi site. What Aztec ruins provides you is an opportunity to see what a reconstructed kiva looks like. Now, a kiva is a ceremony. It's a Hopi word for ceremonial chamber. And you'll see the kivas in all of the sites that I've mentioned before. I don't remember seeing one in Hovenweep, but I know Mesa Verde has them. I know Chaco has them. And you see them, and they are these very large, round stone pits that were built. You see what they look like now as ruins. What Aztec ruins lets you see is what they believe one to have looked like back when these ruins were inhabited. The reconstructed kiva at Aztec ruins is, again, it gives you a glimpse into something you would never have imagined you would see. You see them at all the other sites, and they're the round stone pits, but getting down inside that reconstructed kiva, it gives you kind of an idea of, you know, what anthropologists think the inside of kivas from what written descriptions they do have, what the inside of an actual kiva look like. And it is a ceremonial chamber. There are a couple of places where there were fires lit as well, and the light is very unique. A couple of the pictures that I took when I was in there, there's a small slits in the ceiling for light to shine in, and you're able to stand in the light. And it does have a very spiritual feel to it. Even if that's not your particular religion, it does have a very spiritual feel to it. And again, it's something that is unique in the national parks. It's not something that seems to be offered by a lot of the other Indian ruins parks. They don't go heavily into reconstructions on a lot of these, which, you know, has its good and bad points. It leaves does leave a lot to the imagination.
In this whole area, the best day you had?
The best day I think I had in this area would be, you know, I love traveling with my dad. It's a father and son bonding thing. Somebody like me, there's obviously a genetic of travel there. My parents have traveled all over the world, but my dad and I travel together sometimes, just the two of us. And we had a great day where we took in Mesa Verde in the morning. And it was real rainy in the morning. In fact, we left our campground in Cortez at 7 a.m. and it was just pouring down rain. And we got all the way up on top of the Green Table, and we looked down over the ruin, and we thought, well, we really don't want to walk down this in the rain. And we went back and sat in the van for a while, and then all of a sudden it cleared, so we were able to walk down into Mesa Verde. And I'd visited there a couple of years before by myself, but I had visited there with my family when I was 12 or 13. And that was one of those experiences, reliving it with my dad all these years later. Seeing Verde was one of those things that built my love of travel there. And here I am again experiencing it with my father. And then later in the day, we drove north through the Million Dollar Highway and we got into the 10,100 foot Molass Pass, which is the highest point on the Million Dollar Highway. And we experienced a snowstorm. So we had rain and a snowstorm. And then we drove further on. And at very late in the evening, we came to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park. And we had just a brilliant sunny with a beautiful clouds day and a perfect picture weather. So we experienced just about every season and three completely different kinds of areas all in on one day. Now, we did a fair amount of driving, but boy, we got quite a taste of what the area had to offer in just that one day.
You mentioned camping. We should really say that this is probably a better vacation if you like to camp. I think when we talked before, you said there aren't that many hotels in this area. There's some in a couple of different cities, but it is a better place if you're comfortable in a tent.
Comfortable in a tent. There's some decent campgrounds. If you're a hotel person, it doesn't eliminate the area for you. It just probably will mean you'll be driving further. Because again, we did mention the towns are limited. Moab, Utah has quite an infrastructure for tourism. So does Cortez and Durango, Colorado. And then I mentioned Farmington, New Mexico also has pretty good. On the Arizona side, there's not a lot of anything. The Canyon de Chelly, there's a small town at the, not even really a town, at the beginning of where Canyon de Chelly starts, and they have a couple hotels there, but the hotels are a lot farther between. Now, the Bureau of Land Management and the National Park Service both operate campgrounds, and these are not luxurious campgrounds by any stretch, but they are in areas that you'll remember camping in forever. They're beautiful. It provides a really rustic experience. It's really getting into what this area is all about to be able to camp in these areas. And again, in Colorado, you're going to be camping in mountains. In Arizona, you'll be camping in the desert regions or in a canyon. In Utah, same thing. You'll be in an elevated, a higher up desert, a 5,000-6,000 foot plain where there's desert as well. But yeah, if you're looking, camping is a great way to experience. And I know that's not everybody's cup of tea, but it is certainly a way to really experience the area.
Okay. This is already going to be a longer episode, so going to wrap this up relatively quickly. But one picture that just really is emblematic for you for this area.
I mentioned Gooseneck State Park in Utah, and there's a picture of me sitting out on this little promontory over where you can see the goosenecks in the background. And if you look closely in the picture, you can also see into Monument Valley. Besides the fact that I'm sitting in an extremely goofy little pose there, it's something I look back and you can see it on my face. I have a lot of satisfaction. I'd read about this place for so long, and here I am experiencing this place that I've read about. And Gooseneck State Park isn't the easiest place in the world to find. And here I am experiencing this viewpoint that I'd only to this point read about. And it is everything the Southwest has. You're in an elevated place. You're overlooking beautiful sights in two different states. It's quite a viewpoint. And I have that picture on my wall in every place I've ever lived since then. And it's brings back a lot of fond memories.
And I'm going to try this question out. One sign you saw that made you laugh?
There was one place in Arizona where I saw a rattlesnake crossing sign.
Oh, gosh.
I was running up against the time restriction, so I didn't go back and take a picture of it. Boy, that would have been a priceless one to have. Yeah, it said rattlesnake crossing, and I thought, well, I mean, most people aren't really going to be upset if they run over a rattlesnake, rather that than the rattlesnake get them. So, but yeah, it made me laugh. I thought, yep, only in the desert Southwest in America are they going to worry about a rattlesnake crossing.
Excellent. And then, you know, our final two questions.
I've had them before.
Yes, you have. In fact, on this very episode.
Yep.
You really know you're in the Four Corners area when what?
When you're driving up a hill, and when you get to the top of the hill, you know what's going to greet you at the top of the hill is going to be this amazing viewpoint, this amazing panorama, whether it's in Colorado and its mountains, whether it be in southern Utah or Arizona, where it's a vast desert with the heat waves coming off of the concrete in front of you and splendid formations on each side of the road. You just, every time you come up over a hill, there's going to be something that's going to make you go, wow, that's just really amazing. And it happens so many different places. Every one of these states has those roads where you come up over a promontory and you see just, you know, it's going to be there. But still, every time you're just amazed at what you see.
And if you had to summarize the area in three words, what three words would you use?
I guess the three words I would come up with most would be mountains, canyons and ruins, because despite everything that's available in the Four Corners area, you're going to see a lot of those things, and each of those things are going to differ from site to site. The mountains of Utah are different than the mountains of Colorado. The ruins at Canyon de Chelly are different than that at Chaco or Mesa Verde, and you know, you're going to have the opportunity to see those three things, but in lots of different varieties.
Excellent. Eric, thanks so much for coming back on the show and taking us to a remote part of the U.S.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
In news of the community, I got an email from Rob who said, "My wife and I have been fans of the Amateur Traveler podcast for a few years now. Whenever we are traveling to a new location, the first thing that we do is look for an episode on that location. You have proven to be an excellent resource. I grew up in Arizona, and I'm currently studying medicine in a global scholars program that allows me to study abroad in England, Newcastle upon Tyne, for a year. We are planning on visiting family in Anaheim, California in June, and we're going to spend a few days at Disneyland. While walking to school this week, I listened to your two podcasts on Disneyland, and while they were informative, they seem a little dated. I can tell that you love the place and was hoping to find out if anything, in your opinion, had changed in the last 6 years. I have heard good things about the new shows that have recently started. Do you have any plans on revisiting any of your favorite destinations in the form of an updated podcast? I personally would love to hear another Disneyland podcast before we visit. What is your rule about doing multiple podcasts about the same location?" And that's a good question, so I thought I would answer it on this show. Generally, my rule has been not to do multiple podcasts about a single destination. The two places that I have violated that rule are Disneyland and Disney World, because we've done two shows on each. Probably not ready to go back and visit it. There are certainly some new rides, although it's really surprising how much of Disneyland is not changed over the years. I used to have a map on my wall, as I mentioned in the Disneyland podcast, when I was a kid. And from that map, I can still find my way around Disneyland, even though things have changed. Their Toontown is new since then, for instance. But a lot of this rides, a lot of Frontierland and Adventureland and New Orleans Square and all of those places, are relatively unchanged since that time. Tomorrowland has had an update, but that wasn't that recent. Probably the one new ride in Disneyland itself is the submarines, which is now a Nemo ride and much better than it was before. Not a lot other than that has changed, although there are some new destinations at California Adventure and that possibly need to be updated sometime, at least in a blog post. And with this show already hitting the 40-minute mark, I think we'll end it here. If you have any questions, feel free to leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com or send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And remember, I'm still giving away travel books over on the Facebook fan site at facebook.com/amateurtraveler. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more.